Hey guys, Michael here. Happy New Year. First, to our supporters on Patreon, I want to quickly say thank you for helping us achieve our first goal of passing 200 patrons. You guys are the best. We love all of you. As promised, we're starting to plan our patron-only live movie night watch-along. We'll be posting updates about that on Patreon in the coming days. I also want to do a quick intro for this episode. This episode is a conversation that Brian and I had in December with some of the writing team behind the video game Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order from developer Respawn Entertainment. As someone who was fascinated by video game storytelling, I had a ton of fun hearing about their work. We discuss how the process of writing a video game differs from writing a movie, what the casting process is like, the unique place this story sits in the chronology of the Star Wars saga, and so much more. They were very generous with their time, and I want to say a big thank you to everyone at Respawn who helped make this happen. The whole Beyond the Screenplay team will be back in the next episode discussing one of my favorite films, Children of Men. But for now, let's get into our conversation about Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order. Hi. I'm Michael, and welcome to a special episode of Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we are talking about the video game Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order by Respawn Entertainment. I'm joined by part of the Lessons from the Screenplay team, writer Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And we have part of the writing team for Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order here. We have the narrative lead, Aaron Contreras.
Hey.
And game writer, Megan Fosty.
Hi.
So can you guys kind of, for people that haven't played the game, kind of quickly summarize what is this game about?
So Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order is the story of Cal Kestis, who was a Padawan in the Jedi before Order 66 and the Jedi Purge. So the game is set after Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, and before Episode 4, A New Hope. And you play as Cal a couple years after the fall of the Jedi as he gets recruited in this quest to rebuild the Order and sort of complete his training as a Jedi, as he's being hunted by the Imperial Inquisition.
Awesome. Yeah, and so I love this game. It's really, really fun.
Cool.
Spoilers ahead. We're going to get into all the things, spoil the whole story, because there's just a ton of stuff to talk about as far as writing for video games and differences between writing for video games and film. Kind of the where it fits in the Star Wars timeline, I think, is really interesting. But I was thinking maybe to get started, just to get some background, I'm curious how you guys got into writing for video games.
For me, it was sort of a happy accident. I went to Georgia State University for film. I didn't think that I would be able to be in video games. I thought you had to be a programmer, which is like kind of laughable now because there's so many different disciplines in video games, but I think it's a common misconception a lot of people have. So I got an internship at Adult Swim. I was writing for the website there. And at that time, their website and their games team were the same because they came up kind of doing browser games. But the games team was getting more ambitious and broke off into its own team. They needed a production assistant, and I ended up getting that role. And then tested games for them for a while and started doing little bits of writing under the writer there. And eventually got to a point where we had a developer called Trinket who was looking for a writer for their game Battleship Brigade, and basically submitted my work anonymously to them without telling my boss. Yes. And they ended up picking my work, and that's how I started writing that.
Battleship Brigade is a really fun game. You should go play it if you haven't.
Awesome.
The writing's pretty good too.
It's fine. The rest of it is the better part.
Awesome. And what about you, Aaron?
That's a very long story. I'll give you the super short version. I was into gaming from like a super young age, and then I'm pretty old, so there was these things called MUDs and MUSHes when I was coming up, kind of in the early days of the internet, which were basically text-based online role-playing games. And I got really heavily into those and ended up getting my first job in the game industry was kind of writing and running one of those with a bunch of people. So there's a lot of writing involved with game design, kind of just because of the medium, is all you had was text to describe everything. And then from there, I kind of wandered and worked as a barista and did a whole bunch of other stuff until I finally ended up back in the game industry, working as quality assurance on World of Warcraft in the night shift. And then from there, I just stayed inside the industry and kind of worked my way up. And I came into game writing through game design. So I was a level designer and a content designer before I was a game writer officially, even though kind of my first job in the industry was more writing based. Mm-hmm. Took me a long time to kind of make it there in AAA.
Gotcha. Okay, so that's sort of how you guys got into game writing in general. What was the inception for this project?
So I came on board about almost 2.5 years ago. I haven't even been at Respawn for 2.5 years. As the narrative lead for the project, there wasn't a dedicated narrative role in-house for the game at that point. And I think it had been a Star Wars game for about a year, a little over a year. The team actually was working on a different third-person action-adventure IP for a while, and then it became a Star Wars game once Lucasfilm and Electronic Arts sort of saw the potential of what the team was making. So there was a story outline when I came on board. There was something already present, which our game director, Stig Asmussen, and one of our other writers, Matt Miknovitz, who wrote for the Clone Wars, had put together. Matt is a contractor. He works with us externally. So when I came in, we were really trying to get into our last vertical slice of the game. So it was kind of our last demo before we rolled into full production. And everything's story was kind of coming on a little bit late. And this comes down to, you know, the complicated nature of doing a Star Wars story with Lucasfilm and kind of just trying to figure out what we wanted to do at that time. So that's kind of where I came involved in the process.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. And Megan?
So for me, it was, I've been here, it'll be 2 years in April. So at the point in time that I came onto the project, myself actually and another person on the team, Adnan, we were the first hires for the narrative team under Aaron. So we came in late, like Aaron said, and we were at, I think, version maybe 10 of the beats at that point, and we would go on to maybe 18 before starting the script.
So this is the story beats, which are sort of like an outline of the game, and we worked through a high-level structure of what's the spine of the game going to be from a narrative perspective with Lucasfilm before we really rolled full-on into story production. And as Megan said, there's a lot of versions of that document.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, because so that's, you know, I'm obviously very familiar with how movies are made, and there's sort of like preset roles that have been established for years and years. And so, you know, the screenwriter does this and producer and blah, blah, blah. I'm curious, like, what does narrative lead mean? Like, what does game writer mean? Like, what does it mean to write a video game?
I don't know. I think there might be one other person in the industry that I know of who has the title of narrative lead, and they're also at Respawn on the Apex team. Basically, I own or I'm responsible for everything narrative inside the project. So I report to the game director, who's sort of the showrunner equivalent for the video game.
Okay.
And everything story and narrative kind of goes through me and my team. So the cinematic team reports up to me, the writers report up to me, and the narrative designers report to me. And we have narrative designers. That's another title, which is very unclear, depending upon studio by studio, what that means. Sometimes a narrative designer is effectively a writer. That's their primary skill set. Here we try to define that as a game developer, like a system designer or a game designer or a content designer who's working on things with a purely or primarily narrative focus. So an example of this would be the companion character, BD-1, your little buddy droid. Mm-hmm. We have a narrative designer owning BD-1 because he's a character who's being realized in the world. So narrative kind of owns that system compared to combat or level design.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's one of those interesting things with games is film tends to be someone writes a screenplay, then that screenplay gets turned into something. And sometimes the person who wrote the screenplay isn't even involved. Whereas obviously with a game, you have game design and storytelling, narrative and dialogue and combat, it's all sort of being developed at once. So like, what is that like from the, you know, from your perspective, sort of that collaboration between the level designers and writing and all that stuff?
It's kind of everything from our perspective. Yeah. And it's maybe one of the primary differences and between, you know, linear media, whether it's television or film or even stage and a video game, because we only have partial ownership over the experience. Even though you typically have a director or writer in a film who's kind of like deciding what happens and how it happens, that script is sort of the blueprint for everything that is being realized in the world. Right. And that's just not the case mm-hmm. in video games because you have the player there deciding what to do if you're inside interactive content.
Right.
And we want to have as much of the game be interactive and have the player involved with that as possible because that's sort of the the possibility space and opportunity for our art form compared to linear media.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the whole thing right there, is that relationship and that process.
Yeah, it has to be highly collaborative. Like an ego can really kill something that you're trying to work on. Like you need to be the kind of person who's willing to be flexible, and like even if you don't agree with whatever the other person is like trying to do necessarily, you do need to kind of hear them out and understand the point they're trying to get to, because generally you can kind of find a point in between where you're both very happy with the end result. But when you have people that are like stuck in too much, it can become really difficult really fast to actually do either department a service.
So what does this like collaboration look like? Because so they're designing the game and the gameplay while you're writing the story, I'm assuming. Like, how is it just ping-ponging things back and forth? Are there decisions that are made because of, you know, level design that affect story and vice versa? Like, what does that relationship flow look like?
It's super organic, and I couldn't define it as any one particular process.
Yeah.
It also changes depending upon team by team, project by project, even individual by individual. So myself and like the lead level designer could get together and have a conversation about something, but that our flow and our process is not going to be the same as myself collaborating with another level designer, or Megan collaborating with a different level designer. So it's all these different individual conversations, which we've put sort of a structure around. So there are some, you know, meetings that we have, and we make an effort to try and line up. But it just comes down to really one-on-one communication. And then you're also involving art as well, and effects and other departments.
Yeah.
So I don't want to make it seem like it's just these two people that need to communicate.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
usually
yeah.
a whole team. Yeah.
That's really, sorry.
No, it's just rolling chaos is the way I probably describe
yeah, yeah.
it.
I feel like that's really important, though, because that helps keep it, you know, I love that you use the word organic. So it's not just like, oh, we have a spreadsheet and then we fill out this and then the other person has to take that and do it, you know, which that's helpful for structure, but it's really nice to say, okay, we just sat down and we chatted and, you know, and agreed on what we wanted to do, and then we just moved forward. And I think that just feels really refreshing to hear.
Yeah, I've worked on teams that have been like, so I worked on Assassin's Creed for Black Flag, and that team, that was not Assassin's Creed 4. If you look at like all the releases they've done, it was maybe like 8 or something.
Right.
So that group, even though it wasn't the same exact core team that had made Assassin's Creed 1, there was a process and a system for how they did that, which made that much more methodical, stepping through the process of developing the game. At the same time, oh, you know, and we'll do this eventually too, your process will calcify, and there kind of will be a way you do things which limits what you kind of can do or what you see as being possible on the team.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, Fallen Order is the first game that this team has made together, so we're kind of coming to it new, and even Megan and myself haven't even been here for more than a hot minute, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very wild and chaotic right now.
Yeah, we're still figuring it out for sure, but I think that's kind of the nice thing about it is like, now that we do have that experience together and we've all like shipped something together, it becomes a lot easier the next time to be like, oh, okay, here's where we kind of went wrong last time. Like, let's fix this a little bit earlier and like talk about things a little bit more. Because communication really is key when you have that many departments involved.
Yeah, it really does. Like you were saying, Brian, it feels like refreshing. Like after having, you know, my mind stuck in the filmmaking ways for so long, like the rolling chaos sounds like really fun because it, like you're saying, if you're doing it for the first time, you don't know what the limits are. You don't know what you can't do. And you're not kind of already cutting yourself off, I imagine. And so, yeah, I'm curious, have you guys written for more, like you were saying, like linear media, like film, TV, like were you writing other kinds of media and then came to video game writing? And if so, like what has been the biggest difference, do you think, for you in that process?
I've only ever wanted to make video games artistically, so I've never done anything else.
Cool.
I've never done anything else professionally, so except for like some website writing and things like that. So I don't have like a professional or super informed opinion. What I knew from school, there was a lot of importance sort of put on this auteur theory and this idea of like the single creative point of view, which I hated like super much. Like the whole thing that was really exciting to me about video games was the idea of working on a team of people and collaborating together. So it's been really nice to have that. And I think the longer I spend in my career, the more I realize that I was super right about that. And like people who want single creative control over things are generally the absolute worst people to work with.
Yeah. You know, we've talked to a couple game writers recently, and every time I hear about this collaborative process, it just makes me wish film was done that way. And it kind of feels like a TV writer's room, which I think is more collaborative. But I'm curious, like, when you're actually on the ground, like, day to day, what does this collaboration, like, look like? And I guess maybe, so jumping back a little bit, big picture, when you're designing a story, so when you're designing the story for Fallen Order, do you start big picture, like you're saying, is it beats and like figuring out macro level stuff and then drilling down, or what's that process
right like? Is it like, you know, in a film it's like, oh, here's our three act structure and here, you know, the beats and blah blah blah, is it that, or is it more just sort of here's what we want and then here's what happens in between those points?
We are not a narrative driven studio, so the process of developing the game is not coming to the table from narrative saying, here's our three act structure, here's the story we want to tell, now let's develop a game around that. It's usually a bit more driven by design and art and narrative and other departments kind of simultaneously throwing ideas at each other. And then we start kind of the limbo dance of how we're going to make this work. So there's usually a number of ingredients that come in, like design wants to do an ice planet, or we're going to have this feature in the game, or Lucasfilm really wants us to go to this location if it's a Star Wars thing. So there's things that the box is being defined, not by the narrative team. I'd say we're a part of that. We're part of defining the box, but we're just one part of it. And then from that point forward, we're constantly looking and reevaluating at what's the story we're telling, because we are going to try to apply like arcs in a three-act structure or some sort of formal structure to it to generate a satisfying story for people. But the pieces keep moving throughout development. So maybe something will get cut or something will get added, or you'll think you'll have 4 hours of content here and it ends up being two, or you think you're going to have one and it ends up being six. So it's this kind of amorphous thing that builds over the course of development until you kind of like lock it down.
Right.
Yeah.
It's impressive because it feels like that shouldn't then make a game that feels like a strong narrative. It almost feels like that's like a recipe for disaster of just like, oh, now we have to like paste this together into a story. But I mean, you guys nailed it. And then not only are you combining all those things, I also love that it sort of feels like it's all Star Wars in this one game. Like the game feels like this very coherent thing, but it references the prequels and the original trilogy. It feels like the original trilogy, which is what everyone wants. Rogue One, obviously. And even like I got a little Last Jedi from the Force sensitive, you know, children and that kind of thing. And I just thought it was like, what an impossible task basically to take something that sort of respects all of the different Star Wars movies but feels like its own thing.
Thank you, that's really high praise. We definitely set out to do that intentionally, where we were huge fans of Star Wars and kind of what that means. We just want to kind of bring that forward for everybody, you know, who enjoyed it in any form that it's appeared in.
Yeah, and I think it was good too that this idea of what Star Wars is was, I think, very different for each of us and very personal.
Right.
And that's not just true of the writing team, that's true of the whole narrative team and really the whole team itself. So we kind of were able to get a lot of different elements in there because we all had a different sort of angle that we were looking at it from.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of collaboration. So as far as the actual story, because I agree with everything Brian was saying, it feels like the most cohesive Star Wars story almost. Like, it really does feel like it touches everything, and there's so much for it to touch. And it is also this kind of very personal story. Like, it's just, there's a central protagonist and just kind of a handful of characters that you get to know, and you're kind of seeing it all from that perspective, which I thought was really effective and just so much fun. So where did that story come from? How did it evolve? Like, what was the inception of Fallen Order storyline?
The seed of it goes back to, again, Stig Asmussen and Matt McNevitz, who came up with the idea of this David and Goliath story of a Padawan who survived the Purge, who then kind of picks himself back up a few years later and goes on to complete his training, go through a hero's journey, and go on this quest to rebuild the Jedi Order. As Megan and myself got involved with it, we wanted to really go deep into the time period that we're like our setting. And one of the first problems that we talked about with like, okay, we're telling a story before A New Hope, so we know what happens. Like we kind of have the Rogue One problem, right? Of like, well, you know, we know what happens to these guys at the end of the movie. So the challenge was, how do we make this a meaningful and valid story given that constraint? And it ended up being, you know, once we looked at it long enough, and more of an opportunity than a limitation, where we're going really hard into these dark times and what it means. And the game tries to ask the question of the player and of the audience, you know, what does it mean to be a Jedi now that the Jedi are fallen? So that was kind of the point of departure, I think, for me, that I remember looking back on it, hindsight being 2020, as to what where the kind of the core of the story idea started to branch into, you know, everything else.
Which, by the way, I watched Rogue One last night, and as soon as K2SO showed up, I clenched a little because I thought I was going to have to fight him.
Oh my God.
Don't let him hug you.
In the vertical slice, by the way, that fight, unwinnable. Yeah. It was so hard. Oh my God. It was like the first thing I played when I came onto the project, and I was just like, oh no.
So what does vertical slice mean, actually, for people that aren't familiar with that term?
So a vertical slice is a term for a demo in a game where ideally all the ingredients that you're experiencing inside the vertical slice are of shippable quality.
Okay.
So it's like a, at least in theory, they're never truly this sure. way, right? But you're seeing a very small slice of the game, but vertically it goes all the way up to 100, right?
I see. So
it looks like final art. So if you were to sort of look at that vertical slice and then imagine, you know, instead of it being an hour long, or I think ours was about 3 hours long, it was by far and away the most impressive vertical slice I've ever experienced. You can imagine the entire game. You could be like, this is what we're going to get if you're, say, a video game executive.
Gotcha.
Looking at that.
Yeah. And so is that like kind of the first thing you try to get right? Like, does that happen before even the rest of the stories put in place?
It depends on team by team and project by project, because every team has their own process. You know, some teams might have the story kind of locked more than ours was. Probably many teams do at that point in time, but others may not. You know, for some, story may come super, super late. Mm-hmm. It all depends upon where you're going to put your resources and your emphasis. Before you do the vertical slice, though, in game development, you're probably going to have a period of pre-production where you're going to be inside little, like, they call them gyms or test levels, where developers will work out features for the game and sort of like look at things in isolation. So you could have like imagine like the Matrix, right? Sort of like you load into a room and it's you and a bunch of stormtroopers. And that's our lightsaber combat. And somebody's working on that kind of in a box, in a vacuum, a little bit by themselves. And they're checking in with other departments, trying to see where things are going on to make sure that they're not moving their feature in a direction that's not going to be in line with the rest of the game. Mm-hmm. But everybody's kind of doing their own thing. And then the vertical slice or demos like that are where things kind of playable demos are where things kind of come together. And everybody sort of see, it's like the band coming together, and then you have that first jam session, and then you figure out how you need to adapt everything in order to make it sound good.
That's such a great analogy, because I've been in bands. It's like, I know that feeling, like, I worked so hard on this, and then we got together, and it's like, oh, right, if we play this at the same time, it doesn't work, okay.
And that's really that kind of, going back to the rolling chaos thing, or sort of like the process of story development in games, and how it's a bit stop-start, and how we're editing things all the time. It's just like that, you know? We could have a beautiful story arc planned out, but if it doesn't work for what the player is going to be doing in that section of the game, we have to kill it, you know? Mm-hmm. Or same happens to other departments as well. It's this kind of like rolling negotiation and trying to figure out what's the best experience going to be for the player.
Right.
Beyond the Screenplay is sponsored by Skillshare. Make 2020 a year where you explore new skills, deepen existing passions, and get lost in creativity with Skillshare's online classes. What you find might surprise and inspire you. Skillshare is an online learning community for creators, where millions of people come together to take the next step in their creative journey. On Skillshare, you can find thousands of inspiring classes on topics including design, photography, video, freelancing, and more. For example, I recently enjoyed Brandon Wolfel's class, Instagram Worthy Photography, Shoot, Edit, and Share. As a filmmaker, I usually think about using the language of film to tell a story over time, so I've always been amazed by photographers who can tell a story in a single frame. In Brandon's class, he walks you through how to have a casual but creative photo shoot that can help you learn photography basics and inspire new ideas. Watching his videos inspired me to go out and do a for fun shoot with some of my friends, which honestly I don't do enough of and I want to do more of this year. So if you're interested in exploring your creativity, head to skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay to get 2 months of premium membership. Once again, that's skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay to get 2 free months of premium membership. Thanks to Skillshare for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
So it sort of sounds like the general process is everyone working on their own thing, bring it together, check in, go work on their own thing, bring it together, check in, and kind of slowly getting closer to the final piece. And then, like, what are the last weeks like? Like, when you finally, like, what is it like when it's like, okay, we have to ship the game and, like, put it all together? What's that experience like?
Yeah, it is crazy. And it's interesting, too, because it's different for different departments. So, for instance, for us in narrative, we have, like, VO lock, which has to happen generally much before the rest of the developers are done working, because we have to get all of our VO re-recorded for localization. And that has to be done before certification. And so you have, like, these kind of, do I need to define those terms a little bit? Or
sure.
Okay, yeah. Good. Yeah. So basically, localization are a team that translates the game into other languages. So they'll do the VO recording in other languages as well as the text translations. But the VO has to happen first because they also have to cast those characters for the other languages, of course. And then certification is a process that the, like, first party consoles use. Steam, I think, also has a certification process, but it's much, like, it's a little bit more lax. Whereas, like, the Xbox One, PlayStation 4, they're, like, quite intense. Actually, I think Nintendo is the most intense, but we didn't ship on that platform. So you really, really want to make sure that your game is super polished before cert. And so that happens because you have to pass cert in order to publish on those consoles.
And how do you pass cert? Is just they're playing and make sure it all works and is put together? Or, yeah.
Basically, like, a largely bug-free experience. And then there's also some, like, TRC checks, which are basically, like, when I press the Xbox button, does it do what it's supposed to do? And things like that are kind of platform-specific.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. There's all those other elements on top of, like, I'm coming at it from a movie standpoint, where it's like, once you finish the movie, it is kind of what it is, and there's, like, maybe other, like, standards you have to export it as, but then it's done. But because it's interactive, there's all these other points of, like, stress, I imagine, of, like, making sure it all works. I was like the editing process in filmmaking, because that's when it all kind of finally comes together and you realize, okay, this thing that we wrote the script and spent a bunch of months shooting it, and then we finally put it all together and it's like, oh, this is a story. And then, like, you put the music in and the sound mixing and, like, suddenly it's a movie, and that's always a really fun feeling. I was just curious what that, if that happens in game making.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's sort of a long phase where the game is playable in chunks, or you might, you know, run through a level and it looks almost done, and then all of a sudden you turn a corner and, oh gosh, there's nothing here, depending upon the production and the process. But there's usually a phase where you're, you know, going in and before things are really locked, or even a little bit after lock for things like VO lock or localization lock, and you're sneaking in lines here and there, you're tweaking things, we're making cuts to cinematics or editing cinematics up until when audio needs to really, like, do the music and scoring for that. That usually locks that down finally. And the gameplay is changing as well. So there's all these different things happening. And then in games also, there's bugs that we have to deal with, which is a huge part of that process of, like, oh, this, we need to, you know, resolve these issues to have a good playable experience. And probably, you know, the vast majority of that pressure lands on our production team and on our game director, who are sort of, like, in these triage meetings, looking at the status of the game every day. And you're shooting for perfection, but you're trying to, you know, how much do we push to put new stuff in that's going to make a positive impact, and how much do we focus on not putting anything in, not making any changes, and making our experience more stable and smooth for players?
Interesting. Kind of, so getting back to sort of the storytelling, one of the things Brian and I were talking about was we thought the flashback, like, mechanic was such a cool way of giving exposition and kind of establishing, you're teaching the player things and while the character is also remembering and learning, and there's just a nice confluence of the narrative is being moved forward and also the player's experience is being moved forward, and it's providing this awesome backstory, and it, like, the flashbacks even have an arc and have a really fun payoff. So I'm curious, how early was that part of the process, and what was the the thinking behind.
I don't think that was especially early. I think that was maybe kind of mid to late change.
It was definitely late because for a while those things were very disconnected.
Interesting.
And I think it was actually your idea to connect them. Maybe you were mad. I can't remember. But yeah, that ended up working really, really well because we were finally able to like understand those a little bit better of like what they needed to do and were doing for the story as well as for gameplay.
So like what parts were disconnected? Like there were flashbacks, but they weren't.
So where we started with this project was you're going to acquire certain abilities at certain locations to move through certain physical gates in the game world.
Okay.
It's very design driven. Like at this point, you can fly. The Jedi can't fly, but and then we, kind of fell on narrative than other teams to sort of contextualize that and make it fit into his hero's journey in the story. And then there's this other X factor of the Force and how did Jedi learn abilities and powers? And that was a very complicated process of learning how to really realize the Force in a way that felt 100% Star Wars, but also felt really satisfying from a game progression standpoint. You want to get that new ability in a game, see the UI pop up, and then go use it and feel like you're empowered, right? And we really wanted all those things to kind of, again, converge together, I think was the word used, in a harmonious way. And we knew we had the backstory with Cal's mentor, Jar T'Pol, and we knew, I think, before we really locked down the format of these things, that he was involved with these. But at various points, it was like more of an active thing where like his ghost is coming out, and it's not his ghost, but like you have a vision about him. So it's Cal kind of in the moment as an adult going through these challenges or dealing things. And there was a little bit of an inconsistency where like maybe one he's young and another one he's old. And we sort of had to like, just iterate through it. Iteration is everything in video games to the point where we saw, oh, OK, here we go. We're going to introduce Jaro early in the game. So you know who he is. We're going to establish a relationship with him as this sort of like terrifying figure who scares Cal in the train vision. And then you're periodically going to check in with him and you're going to see young Cal's relationship with him. And then that's going to pay off in the Order 66 moment and in the kind of like a dark breaking of Cal immediately afterwards. Mm-hmm. So once we saw that kind of lined up, and it took a while to get there, we knew we were onto a good path.
I love that that sequence, just the fact that you start in the hallway, you're like, oh, why aren't we just in the training room yet? And you're just like talking to the stormtroopers and they're your buddies and you're like, hey man, how's, and then I love that once you get up to Jar T'Pol, the Order 66 happens just sort of in the background, like you almost don't even notice what's going on, and then suddenly like all hell breaks loose. And I just thought that was such a cool piece of storytelling.
For me, that whole sequence is probably the heart of the game. So
yeah.
I'm so happy with the team that realized it. A level designer, a narrative designer on our team, basically operated as a level designer on the project. She had a level design background named Jessica Campbell, and she worked on the flashbacks and Order 66. And it's just, I'm very, very happy with how it turned out.
That's awesome. Yeah. When it's a great way to make this big thing that happens so personal. Like, I feel like that's always one of the struggles in storytelling is when you're trying to convey this epic thing that's happening and has all the significance. One of the best ways is to make it personal so you understand to the person what this means, and then you can kind of extrapolate.
Right.
And it was, it's such a great example of that, of like, we know what Order 66 is from episode 3, but I feel like I felt it so much more because of the time investment and the flashbacks that happen.
Episode 3, it was a montage, and like some of the Jedi, you didn't even know who they were and that kind of thing. And this was just one character who loses his mentor and then is dealing with it, 10 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I think, the power of video games and interactivity is that you become young Cal in that moment. Mm-hmm. And that kind of really allows a certain different experience through it for you to sort of feel like it's happening to you. And it makes it very personal. Definitely.
And it feels like the game is very unified, like thematically around this, like all the characters are kind of struggling with this thing that happened. And I'm always curious how much theme plays into different people's process. And so, was that something like, do you guys have conversations about theme early on? Is it kind of a thing that organically emerges as you're working? What's your kind of relationship with theme?
Because there was this early structure for a story before Megan and I came in, we had to find it in an exploratory way, I think, because there was something there that we were kind of chipping away at or digging through in order to find sort of what we wanted to bring out as the primary themes. Mm-hmm. But there was definitely conversations, long conversations and arguments about theme. all the way through development.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was an important part of it. We talked a lot about the ideas of like persistence through failure. That's a big thing for like basically every character fails in some way. And basically how they have to get past that or get through that. We talked a lot about just the general sort of idea of trauma and how it doesn't really leave you, but how you still sort of have to process it. And we see the characters process it differently. Sierra processes it, for instance, through the lens of an adult and someone who made a decision as an adult, whereas Cal processes it as a child and someone who's now older and has become an adult but has lived with that from the very beginning, and it looks very different for the two of them. So yeah, those things were very prominent. I also was always like family, but Aaron was less like, that was one of the theme disagreements. The yeah. Mm. But you know, the idea of, I think, being connected and, having that be like very important, I think is definitely there.
We see it in the game where Cal is, and I think the bridge that we found between, say, the theme of failure and the theme of family is trust. So Cal's learning to trust himself. Sir's learning to trust herself. They're also learning to trust each other. So that's kind of where we found a way to have those two different arcs or directions kind of like play back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Between characters.
Yeah, and it almost feels like that becomes, it's like the plot of the story is about this list of the four sensitives and everything, but then it almost feels like what you're left with at the end is exactly what you said, that they trust each other and they are a family at the end. Like, where are we going next? You know? Because I was thinking about, you talk about the Rogue One problem, and I think it's interesting to set a story in between two trilogies where we know the big picture of what happens before and what happens later. And, you know, the choice at the end, I wonder how much this is a narrative sort of mandate, the choice at the end, they destroy the holocron with the list of the four sensitives. And I was thinking, like, it feels like such a major thing to have this list, but in order to like not screw up what the original trilogy is, you can't have them be like, and then they all, you know, formed and they made a new Jedi Order, and you know,
right.
I was thinking the weight of, and it's sort of Rogue One does this too, the weight of if they failed at their plan, then things, you know, horrible things happen. So you are very invested in them not failing. But then to succeed at the plan is to sort of make this status quo. To succeed at the plan isn't to make some major change in the universe. To succeed is to basically quiet this list and then say back to normal. You know, so how much, I guess my main question is, how much was that basically finding the balance between not changing too many things in the world, but also making a story that feels important and big?
Yeah, I think we're really into that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's something that we struggled with over the opening section of working on Fallen Order, and now we're really into these dark times, and I think we have a crew of people who we're excited to explore more stories with. Mm-hmm. And this is a really fascinating period in Star Wars history. So there's, you know, there's a whole lot of potential there. With the list of Force sensitives, we do try and establish that, like, the second sister would get it,
right?
Eventually, if you fail,
right?
So you do avert some disaster there, mm-hmm. right? Of mm-hmm. the Emperor, like, you know, chipping all these kids or killing them or bad things happening to them. At the same time, yeah, we want to preserve the status quo because we can't change what happens in A New Hope,
right?
But Luke isn't on that list. But, you know, I always imagine when Cal is looking at that sort of galaxy map at the end, and he's seeing those little points of light which represent the Force sensitive children, that mm-hmm. like one of them is the one who's eventually gonna, you know, be the new hope,
right?
So that still has meaning, I guess. Yeah. But it took a while for us to really work through that in a way that felt like it paid off.
Yeah, I thought it was really impressive that basically to say the thing that they're setting out to do, they sort of make that choice to destroy it, and instead of feeling deflated by the ending, I just felt happy. I felt like, cool, like, great, that was a good decision, I totally agree with it, I'm on board with why you made that choice, and I'm excited to go off to the next adventure now.
Part of that too, I think we needed to have that sequence where Cal has, so he goes through Cordova's test, he gets the Astrum, he goes back to Pagano, mm-hmm. and then he has that experience in the vault, which sort of shows him what will happen if he gets what he's wishing for.
Right.
And I feel we really needed that otherwise that choice at the end was going to ring hollow for people who weren't picking up on all the subtext. Mm. That's kind of in that premonition sequence. We come out and say, hey, here's what's going to happen. Here's what Cal's dealing with, mm-hmm. both inside himself and what's going on in the galaxy. So right. I feel that was really important to making that ending work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a really great moment, I think, of emotional maturity for Cal as well, because he looks at this and he's like, well, I can take this power. I can do this thing. But by doing so, I'll also be taking away the choices of all these children in the same way that the choices were taken from me, from Trilla, from Marin. So they represent sort of a whole sort of generation of people who had their choices removed from them by the Empire and the Clone Wars in some shape or form.
Or even the Jedi.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, and that sequence is such a, I think that's a great example of what games can do, or like you were talking about the sequence where Cal's sort of saying what could happen if he took this power. And it's fun to see that kind of sequence in gameplay, because, you know, in a movie it might just be like a montage or he like sees visions, but to be physically moving through the spaces and seeing it, like feeling like you're there, I think it is this kind of interesting, you're affected by it in a way that I think you aren't when you're just watching it in a movie. Mm. And I also just think it's such cool story design that it's, you know, it's this video game where you're trying to find this list of things, and it's like kind of almost a MacGuffin-y thing where it's like, we're trying to get this thing. And like all video games kind of have something like that.
You could say it's MacGuffin.
Yeah. But it's like, it's used so well because it's, you know, what the story is actually about is the things that our characters learn on the journey to find the thing. And then by the time they find it, the way they feel about it has changed, and the way we feel about it has changed. And
right.
like, it's just, I'm basically just saying it's really great.
Cool.
And just like how it was built into the gameplay and how you evolve, it all worked really, really nicely.
Yeah, the Holocron list was definitely our bridge to Star Wars. It's our version of the Death Star in Rogue One.
Mm.
But I think you hit it there. For us, the story is these characters and what they go through, and how it marks them along the way, for sure. I think that's what people come away caring about the most. The list is there as a vehicle. It's
right.
It's not, you know, if you're thinking about the list 6 months after, I feel like I've failed.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
We want you thinking about Grease and BD-1 and Yaddle, yeah. And, you know.
Yaddle.
Hey everyone, it's Alex. Just wanted to take a quick moment to thank you for listening to Beyond the Screenplay. If you like the podcast, we'd really love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps us to grow the show. Also, if you want to help us continue to make these episodes, you can become a patron on Patreon. For $2 a month, patrons get patron-exclusive Q&As and extra mini-episodes like our opening weekend reactions to The Rise of Skywalker. Anyway, back to the episode.
One question I just had is, as far as like casting, like, is that something you guys are involved in?
Yeah.
Like, the casting is amazing. Can you talk about what that process was like, kind of how you... Like, are you thinking about people when you're designing the characters, or kind of what that process is like?
To sort of speak back to of how we came together as a team globally on the Star Wars team, but it's maybe especially in narrative very rapidly over the course of the project. We were casting hot. Like, we were kind of building the bridge as we were running across it the entire time on this mm-hmm. production. So that was very interesting, where we had a couple rounds of casting sides that were, let's say, off target. And we had to do, you know, sometimes you'll call back with the same performer who ended up getting the part. And we were kind of like dialing in who the character is along the way. But one thing that's interesting about our casting process is that we didn't assign or sort of predetermine any kind of ethnicity for any of our characters. Mm-hmm. So we insisted on our casting team, just show us people. Like, here's mm-hmm. this person's personality. Find performers who can do that sort of thing. Like, there's age in there as well, and in most cases gender, but we push for that, to sort of like, we don't care.
Yeah.
And that was really awesome. Problematic, actually. It was really tricky. Casting doesn't work like that.
Right.
Looking for a person. Open auditions tomorrow.
And so once it was cast, like, did that kind of change the characters at all, and how so?
I think all the way across the board, every performer brought their own personality to the part, and they all did a fantastic job, and it changed every character, sometimes in ways more meaningful than others, but we found the final version of each of these characters inside the person who was realizing them for us.
Yeah, it's another collaboration. You start to hear the way that someone speaks and you start being able to write that. And you start to really just associate, like sometimes I'd accidentally call Deborah Sear. You know what I mean? Like you just start thinking about them as this person and it makes a whole lot of difference in terms of like, okay, we have this character who is named Sear and this is what she does and this is how we think about her. And then you have the person who is Deborah come in and just give this performance where you like can't look away from her and she's incredible. And you're like, oh my God, I'm a hack. But like, it's really so amazing to like hear someone elevate the thing that you've done and just make you want to like write the best possible thing to give to that person.
Mm-hmm. I had a weird like just VFX moment where I, as soon as she showed up, I was like, I recognize her from the Wolfenstein 2 trailer. I didn't even play the game. I'm like, wow, we live in a world now where I can recognize an actor from a different video game I saw them in. And then my girlfriend walks in the room. She said, oh, it's the kid from Shameless, like immediately, without even a second. I was like, wow, okay, that's where we are now.
Another huge part of how those characters changed from the page to the game, let's say, would be our performance director, Tom Keegan, who actually directed the Wolfenstein game cinematics as well. Who is a actor's director, and he had a huge part. He worked with us very intensely on digging through every line of the script, which was a long script, and making sure that he understood everything that was going on inside the internal worlds of all these characters, and then working with the performers to kind of help them get it. He was such a huge part of the process, and for sure it wouldn't have been it wouldn't turn out as well as it did without his involvement.
Yeah, Tom is incredible.
Yeah, that's really cool. I feel like to this day people still think that, you know, cinematics and stuff are just what happens between gameplay. Like, it's just like something you have to paste on. It's like, no, people have to work really hard to make those things happen.
Well, like, and the performance comes across so like beautifully in the final game. Like, I feel like it's one of the best like renderings of this. Like, yeah, I was watching it and it felt just like watching a movie. I didn't even have that kind of, you know,
video
the
game
veil
filter.
Of,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. It was like just watching it completely engrossed in everything. So I always like to talk to people about their writing process because I feel like that's something I'm always struggling with, is trying to figure out like, how do I make myself write? What are the ways I write best? How do I design my day to be as effective as possible? So I'm curious for each of you guys, what does a day of writing look like? On a day that you actually get writing done, what does that look like?
So for me, basically, I have this process that I do that I learned from my mentor, Brandon Kramer, who I worked with at Adult Swim. And I was once very much struggling trying to write a description for a show that I did not care for. And he was like, write all the things you want to write about it. Like, do the satire first, and then you'll have what you need. Like, you can go from there. So what I do is I write what I call shitpost drafts, where basically it's anything that comes out of my head. So it's all jokes, it's all stupid, it's all references, there's like tons of cursing, there's like just all kinds of nonsense in it. But the thing that's really nice about that is that, number one, it shakes off all those like heebie-jeebie writer block kind of things. Another thing that it does is it forces you to approach a scene in a creative way that you might not have thought about if you were taking it really seriously from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then the other nice thing is, and I've started noticing this even more now, once you know a character, you go from the kind of silliness and then they actually start to talk the way that they would as you're writing it. So you really can take something from that very first draft that goes into the final. And then you just iterate, because it's a super iterative process.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. Aaron?
I have a wildly different process.
Cool.
I think every writer probably has a different process across the world. Where I'm a little bit more, I don't know, I might describe it as more deliberate and methodical, slower, too. Where I know where I want, say, a scene to begin or end. I'm talking about scenes here. I'm not talking about, like, outlining.
Yeah.
So I'll have an outline. I do outline. So I know my points of entry and exit, and I obsess over that stuff because I have a game design background. So where a character's standing, what state they're in, what pose they're in, like, that's all stuff that I really need to be able to visualize. Mm-hmm. Just to make the scene work. Otherwise I stop myself, and that's procrastination, right? That's part of the process. Uh-huh. And then I go through in my first draft is typically pretty slow because I really want to find the at least a version of what that scene's about inside it. So if there's a change in a character that happens inside the scene, I need that to see that inside the first draft of the scene. Otherwise, I don't feel it's complete. Doesn't mean it's going to be good or that we're going to keep it or that it's going to be the same action that happens three drafts down the road. But I need to sort of see that one moment or several moments that's critical to it before I can kind of walk away from it and move on. So there's a lot of banging your head against the wall for me. Mm-hmm. And pacing and just kind of like locking myself in a room and kind of staring at it until it comes out.
Yeah.
I feel like those are the two sides of the coin of writing. It's just like the very rigid structure, but then also just the free flow and do whatever you feel like. With lessons from the screenplay and beyond the screenplay, like we will be on a Slack channel just like coming up with titles, and then someone will say something stupid on purpose, and then we'll just start like making jokes. And then when you hit that moment sometimes where you're like, okay, that's dumb, but what if we did this? You know, and suddenly you have that moment where you're like, oh, I'm glad we went on that. Like, glad we shitposted.
You know?
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the reasons I like to talk about it, is because I think I've found that when I try to force myself to have a balance of kind of both these things is usually when like work actually starts to happen. Mm. And I think I naturally am kind of more like you, Aaron, where I'm very like intellectual. I'm going to sit down and like plot it out perfectly and it has to like achieve all the things. But then I reach that point where I'm like, I'm not doing it, so what do I do? And kind of more recently, I've been trying to incorporate like what you were saying, Megan. It's like, I'm just going to write. I'm just going to start throwing things down, and it can be bad, but it gets the brain going and then kind of like lets you have momentum to then return to what you were trying to do with this kind of new energy and maybe a new perspective. So like what apps, programs do you write in usually?
Oh, we're getting nerdy now.
I gotta go a little nerdy. Like, are you pen and paper people? Laptop people?
I always start with pen and paper. Okay. I really like that. This goes back to the sort of how my process works in terms of I'm a highly anxious person and I'm a highly judgmental person. So like I really need to divorce myself from like that blank page that I see on a word processor of any kind. Mm. I can't look at it first. It like fills me with anxiety. Mm. But a notebook is like very personal and feels very comfortable and like a friend. So I can like start in there, write like generally 3 to 4 drafts in my notebook, and then take it to the screenwriting software that I'm going to use. So we use Writer Duet in-house. So that's been our primarily what we've used for cinematics. We also have an in-house tool that one of our tech designers, Dave, created. And it's incredible. Heckle is the reason that you have VO in our game, basically. He created like this whole system. The writing flow in there is very different. It's very scene oriented. So in a scene looks very different in gameplay than it does in a script. So in a script, you would be like, we're all having this conversation and that's the script. Whereas like in gameplay, you know, Cal comes up and he interacts with something and then you and I fire off a couple of lines of dialogue and then we stop. And then he goes over and says something to BD1 off of that. And those are probably 2 different scenes. That way we can like author the triggering of things a little bit better instead of just like going and playing like all the dialogue one right after another.
Interesting.
So for Fallen Order, we had Megan and myself, and then for the majority of the writing, we had 2 external writers, Manny Hagopian, who is from the Apex team, but he's moved to New York now, and Matt McNevitz. So we got people who are offsite, in addition to a couple contract writers who kind of came and left during the process. And Writer Duet allowed us to collaborate real time with people who weren't sitting next to us in the office. And so much of game development is playing the game in iteration, that having a tool that allowed us to sort of work online together real time was huge towards hitting our goal as rapidly as we did. And then the tool that Megan described, Heckle, is our content management system. So that's where we take VO and text and we inject it into the game. And it's a tool custom made for that. It's also web-based. So you can have it up inside a recording session, or if you're offsite somewhere and you want to write some stuff, you can jump in a Heckle there as well.
That's really cool. So I always wonder for those like little lines that people are saying in the environment, like what's it like writing those? Like, because I feel like with like a scene, there's maybe more of a goal you're trying to achieve? And I'm sure there is for those little lines too, but I've just always wondered what it's like to sit down and write, you know, two lines or three lines of that.
Imagine like 5,000.
Well, because then there's also like the codex type descriptions and stuff like that. Is that you guys also, or is that?
Yes, that was us. That was mostly Megan. Yeah. Between the two of us, at least, who wrote the data bank and stuff.
Yeah, I'd say that. Matt as well. Yeah, Matt was probably the heaviest hitter on the data bank, and then I went in and wrote some of them and then edited stuff. But yeah, definitely shout out to Matt on that one because he spent a lot of time and effort on that. But yeah, in terms of what it's like to kind of write those little scenes and things like that, the ones that are kind of in a level and you're kind of going through and BD1 and Cal are talking or something like that, you have to, again, be very collaborative with your level designer and the combat designers and like everyone else who's working on that level, because you sort of have to make sure that there's space for that conversation to even occur, because there's so many things happening in games and you have to account for player choice. If the player hits a VO trigger here and then backtracks, are they going to immediately hit combat and are you going to miss that conversation? So you have to be really, really cognizant of what's happening in the level. You also want to make sure that there aren't sort of things happening all around that are going to distract from what's going on in your conversation. So you have to basically be very aware. You have to be playing it. And it's really nice to play yourself. And also then see how other people play it, because your experience doesn't necessarily match the player experience. So we talk a lot, I think, in games about the player experience. And generally, I've seen a fallacy there of someone talking about their experience, but that's not what the player experience is. It's some kind of weird conglomeration of everybody's, right?
Yeah.
So you have to be kind of like a mind reader, or like, you know, kind of prescient to try to figure out what are all the different instances of the player experience we can see here, and how can I make this work for at least 70% of them or something.
Right, well, because there's like the non-linear, like you don't necessarily know what order people are going to be triggering different conversations, and that just sounds dizzying.
Yes, but fun. It's like, if you're someone who likes a lot of parameters, it's fun.
Yeah, I thought it was a nice touch that we that like environmental storytelling, I always like that kind of thing. It's like you can either look at the environment and say, okay, here's, you know, people cooked here, or then you click on it and then Cal says someone cooked here, and then you get one or two sentences of something, and then if you go into the data bank, then you can actually read the little mini story. And I thought that was a nice way to sort of whatever involvement you want into the storytelling, and the fact that when you click on it, it gives you XP, so it actually motivates you to tell yourself a little bit of the story, or to have Cal tell you where you are and why you're on this random planet that maybe doesn't actually tie to the greater story that much, but you feel, oh, this place feels lived in, and yeah, there's a story here.
Yeah.
On the note of those, the sort of, I don't want to call them random planets, because, you know, they're all obviously part of the game, but what I love about Star Wars movies is that you get kind of three movies in one a lot of time. Like, oh, now we're in this environment on this adventure, and then now we're over here. And I like how much there were these little, like, I was reading back through the synopsis of the game, like, oh, I totally forgot about the origin tree and the, you know, the flying creature. And then, you know, you're Legolasing your way up a AT-AT. It's a badass moment.
That's so cool.
And I guess the question is, like, how do you, and is this you, or is this more of a game design thing to say, we're telling this one focused story, but we have to go to these other environments. And then, you know, how do we tie in Saw Gerrera, and how do we tie in, you know, Dathomir and the residents of Dathomir and that kind of thing, like sort of taking these very almost disjointed feeling planets, but then tying them together in an organic way into the narrative.
It's a combination of sometimes we'll bring things to the table, but probably more often than not, there's like, we want to climb an AT-AT.
Right.
And then we need to work that into the story, or Saw Gerrera is there, and we need to figure out how does he play into the themes of, you know, failure and family and trust and all those sorts of things. And how does he answer that question of what does it mean to be somebody who's lived through the fall of the Republic and the fall of the Jedi Order?
Yeah.
So it's really a combination of both. But happily, Star Wars is huge. So you can ride a giant bird up a giant tree.
Right.
And it kind of fits in the context of everything you're doing.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's sort of, you know, Megan, do you want to speak to the relevance of the She-Ho bird?
Sure. I love the She-Ho bird, you guys. So the She-Ho bird is one of those things that is like, you can tell that there was a developer more than one in this case, who was like super in love with this feature and like really, really wanted it. So for us, that was Robert Bloss, who's the level designer of the Shadowlands. And it was like Bloss and Sabina Rosgren, who's one of our narrative designers, and myself just being like, let's make the Shio bird awesome. And also Adnan as well, because I consulted with him on the like BD1 healing for the Shio bird cinematic and all that stuff. So yeah, we knew that the Shio bird was a thing that was going to happen even before I got on the project, I believe. So it was like, how do we tell the story? How do we make it relevant? And how do we make it connect to the wider story that's going on? And in doing that, it became clear that the Shio bird represented Kashyyyk, the unmarred version of Kashyyyk, something that's been lost, and something that feels free. And of course, very kind of, exhilarating for Cal, because he spends this kind of long walk through Shadowlands very upset with Seer, upset with himself, kind of questioning, like, did I bring the Empire here? Would they have hit back at the Partisan so hard if I hadn't been here? And kind of having this moment of, like, what am I even doing this for? Is this stuff worth it? Can I even trust the people around me? And it's this very low moment. So the Shio bird sort of represents this thing that Cal never really got to have, which is like a real childhood, because even when he was with the Jedi, the Clone Wars were happening, so he was in war as a child. So he never really got that moment to just be a kid and like have fun and be happy with himself. So the Shio bird for him in the story is a moment of connecting with that past that's kind of been taken from him, and it goes back to the theme of choices and choices being taken from people. And, you know, there's a segment you can go to, there's an echo, that is, of, like, Cordova and Tarful talking about the Shio bird, and you know that this is, like, a thing that's been here for a very long time and is connected with Kashyyyk's history, so it's just kind of calling back to those things that are, like, marred and kind of gone now that the Empire is here.
Yeah, and then the Ninth Sister shows up and makes it all, it was very satisfying killing her afterwards. That was a good battle. Awesome. Well, yeah, thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast. I really, like I said, really, really enjoyed the game, and not even just like it was fun to play and it was a good story, but it was a really good Star Wars story. And I feel like it's become actually one of my favorites. Like, it's such a cool, yeah, just a good Star Wars story that's in the world, but not as like super connected to the events, but also extremely connected. It just balances all these things really, really well, and you guys did a really great job.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much. I think if 6 months ago I'd be laying awake, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, what's the best result we could get from how people experience our narrative? And that's probably close to it, of something. This is so Star Wars, but it's also a new thing. So
yeah,
thank you so much.
It was also really satisfying because I grew up playing Jedi Outcast, Jedi Academy, and like Force Unleashed were fun. And but it's just been so long. It's just been like a single player Jedi game where you get to run around with a lightsaber and do things. So it was just very refreshing for that game to be a good game, like and to be a good game in all aspects, you know. So so thank you to you and to Respawn for making a great game.
Yeah, and I'm glad I got to have my purple lightsaber too. I was waiting for that.
Very important.
Yes. Awesome. Where can people find you?
I do have a Twitter. I don't use social media very often, but my Twitter is at Coriander, Coriander.
And I'm just at Aaron Contreras, my first name and last name on Twitter.
Awesome. Cool. Well, yes, thank you guys once again so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will see you in the next episode.
Thank you.
Thanks.